Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a wonderful guest joining me today. Dina Merriam will be joining us to talk about her new book, My Journey Through Time, as well as the organization she founded, Global Peace Initiative of Women. So she'll be coming on in just a little bit. But before she comes on, I want to share with you some things going on in our area, some things in the news you want to know about, and, of course, my weekly recipe. So first off, we've done a lot of talking over the weeks and months about the Farm Bill, and the Senate just passed the 2018 Farm Bill. But before it is completely approved, there are a few provisions in there that we really do not want to see move forward, one of which is the weakening of the National Organic Standards Board, which is the advisory committee that oversees the organic standards for our country. And they are weakening those standards. They're weakening the people that are going to be in that organization. And then they also are allowing non-organic ingredients into our organics. And we really need to strengthen, not weaken, our organic standards. And so I urge you to write to your congressmen and senators and urge them to push for a more comprehensive farm bill that includes protections for organic foods, because that is really essential. So even though I've gotten some emails from like the American Farmland Trust to, you know, support this farm bill, I just can't in my good conscience support a farm bill that is weakening our organic standards. That is the only protection we have against herbicides, pesticides, GMOs, and even with that organic standards that we have, we're still getting some of that contamination. So we really need to strengthen these standards and not weaken them. So I beg you all to get in touch with your senators and congressmen about that. And I do have links on my website for that. Also, what else? There have been so many studies, as we all have been aware of, about climate change and the impact that's going to have on our planet. And there's more and more scientific information about how agriculture can actually help the situation. Right now, it is really contributing to greenhouse gas emissions, and we need to turn that around. And we need to grow more food on less land. We need to stop cutting down the forests that are sequestering the CO2 from the atmosphere into the ground. We need to support more regenerative agriculture and not this monocultured agriculture, industrial agriculture system that we have right now. And it really is going to take a huge overhaul, and we really need to support anything that we can that comes through our email drives, petitions, and work with organizations and groups. And we'll be talking about that later on in the show as well with my guest. But it's really important that we support agriculture in a way that is going to foster cleaning up our environment and our atmosphere and not adding to it. So that is just really, really important. I also want to ask you to tell the EPA to ban chlorpyrifos, which we've talked about many times. It's a pesticide that is just in everything, and it's known to be a carcinogen. It's known to cause cancer, birth defects, brain damage, mental disorders in children, even exposed at low levels. And this administration is actually, again, weakening the standards and making more pesticides allowable in our food. So we really want to fight that. And last week, my guest talked about the coalition of Immokalee workers, and I just want to put a shout-out to them again. The petition or the boycott for Wendy's fast food is continuing. Wendy's is a holdout in participating in the Fair Food Program, which supports paying these farm workers just one penny more per pound. That's it. That's what we're talking about, one penny more per pound. But that one penny more per pound can really impact their livelihoods and make a difference in their lives. So Wendy's is refusing to do that. They tried to take their business to Mexico. They came back to the States, and they're, you know, trying to buy from farms that do not participate in this program. So a big shout-out for the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and the Student Farm Workers Alliance, who I spoke with last week, who are doing really great work in that area. So a few things coming up in our area tonight. Food and Water Watch is having their annual holiday party here on Long Island. They also have one in the city. I'm not sure what day that is. But Food and Water Watch is one of the nonprofit organizations that I really support because they are doing such important work in making us all aware of what we can do as participants to help fight the pipelines that they're building and the infrastructure for fossil fuels and protect our air and water. So they're doing great work. If you want to participate in the holiday party and get more involved in some of their campaigns, that would be great. Starting this Sunday, I Eat Green here at my homestead, we will be starting to cook for the River Fund Food Pantry's annual Christmas event, which will be taking place on Tuesday, December 18th at Rufus King Park. And we cook enough pasta for 1,000 people. We don't usually have 1,000 show up in the park. There's usually more like 800 in the park, but the River Fund New York Food Pantry that I partner with is affiliated with many of the shelters in the local area. So any leftover food gets brought to a woman's battered women's shelter and some other shelters in the area. So if you want to sign up, there's still, I think Sunday's pretty full, but I know there's openings on Monday to sign up, and I have a doodle document on my website that you can sign up with. Also on my I Eat Green Facebook page, which is IEat_Green. And what else? And then lastly, save the date for the NOFA New York Winter Conference, which is coming up January 18th and 19th up in Saratoga Springs. The NOFA New York, which stands for the National Organic Farming Association, is a wonderful organization that really works to promote organic foods in our local region and support good agricultural systems. So come out. They have great workshops. You can find out the schedule and the programming online at nofanewyork.org. And now I'm going to share with you my recipe and then invite my guest on. This week I made a vegan sag paneer. And basically, paneer is a Indian cheese, so it's a mock paneer. But sag is the spinach, also called palak paneer. And it's not really very curried, but it is an Indian dish. And so instead of the paneer, I use tofu, and I use 1.5 blocks of organic extra firm tofu that I cut into 1-inch cubes. 1/2 teaspoon of salt and 3 tablespoons of olive oil, and that's for the tofu. And then 1 teaspoon of turmeric, 1/2 teaspoon of cayenne pepper, and that's optional depending on your spice love. 2 tablespoons coconut oil, 1 pound of frozen spinach, 2 onions finely diced, 2-inch piece of fresh ginger root, 2 teaspoons of garlic minced, 1 bunch of broccoli rabe finely chopped in the food processor, 2 teaspoons of coriander, 2 teaspoons of cumin, 1 teaspoon of garam masala, which is a mixture of spices. You can find it at Whole Foods. You can also find it at any Indian Asian market. It's a combination of herbs or spices that have things like cloves and allspice in it. It's really delicious. And 1 tablespoon of chili pureed with 3/4 cup of coconut milk. And so that's the Thai red curry paste that I'm talking about. 1 tablespoon of that mixed with 3/4 cup of coconut milk and juice of 1/2 lemon. And so you're just going to combine the olive oil, the turmeric, the salt, the cumin together in a large bowl to make a marinade. Place the cubes of tofu into that marinade. Let it sit for about 1/2 hour. If you don't have time to do that, you can certainly just, you know, mix it up and put it in the oven like that. But letting it marinate for 1/2 hour helps the tofu absorb those flavors. Meanwhile, heat the coconut oil in a wok and saute the onions, the chilies, the ginger, and the garlic. And while that's sauteing, pulse the spinach and the broccoli rabe in a food processor until finely chopped. Now, if you're using frozen spinach, which I just said, you can buy chopped frozen spinach, and you don't have to put that into the food processor. It's already chopped enough. But the broccoli rabe you want to chop up until it's finely chopped. Then you add the rest of the spices to the wok. Let that simmer for 10 to 15 minutes. If the onion and garlic mixture starts sticking to the pan, you can add a little water to deglaze it and unstick it. And in a separate heavy skillet, sauté the marinated tofu until golden brown on all sides. Actually, just so you know, you can also put the tofu into a oven that's set at like 450 degrees and just keep your eye on it about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and it will get crispy there as well, and that works really well. So you're going to add the spinach and the broccoli rabe to the wok. Add a half a cup of water to help steam the greens. And once the greens are all soft, you can add the cooked tofu and the coconut milk mixture to the spinach mixture. And allow that all to cook together for about 10 minutes. You can squeeze in half a lemon right at the very end before serving. And you can serve it with some saffron rice. And that is it. It's super delicious. And of course, I always love feedback. So if you do make the recipe, send me a little note and let me know how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Dina Merriam. She's the founder and convener of the Global Peace Initiative of Women and author of the new book, My Journey Through Time, a spiritual memoir of life, death, and rebirth. Dina is also a managing partner and vice chairman of the Finn Ruder Incorporated, where she works in cultural marketing, creative services, and works for religious and nonprofit organizations. In her spare time, she serves on the boards of the Interfaith Center of New York, AIM for Seva, and the Dharma Drum Mountain Buddhist Association. Dina is a former member of the board of Harvard University's Center for the Study of World Religions and the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. She was co-chair of the Millennium World Peace Summit, the first summit held at the United Nations General Assembly for more than 1,500 of the world's religious leaders. And I also invited her on, of course, to talk about her new book, My Journey Through Time. So, Dina, are you with me?
I am. And thank you for the introduction.
Sure. Well, thank you for taking time in your busy schedule to join me today. The work you're doing is incredible, and so is your book. But let's start with the Global Peace Initiative of Women. Can you tell us a little bit about this organization that you started and how you got involved with its work?
And I'll tell you what we're doing, a little bit about the beginnings and then where we are now, because it's relevant to your introduction. I've just returned from the COP meeting in Poland. And so I can share some of that information. But I first began this about 20 years ago when I sort of backed into the interfaith work. It was never my intention, but I was invited to help organize this big summit at the UN. And in the process, I noticed that there were very few women in senior positions in the religious organizations. And also it was very heavily Abrahamic, with very little participation from the Dharma traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism. So I got involved in organizing a follow-up summit, really organized by women spiritual teachers and by the Dharma traditions, which we held at the UN in Geneva, to help create greater balance. And from there, I mean, I thought that was all I was going to do in that field, but then we got calls to come work in conflict areas to help bring spiritual resources for dialogue there. So I began bringing spiritual teachers, men and women, but the organization, the vision was held by the women, to areas of conflict. And then in 2009, the UN was having its climate conference in Copenhagen. And we received a grant to bring a delegation of spiritual teachers there to talk about the spiritual dimensions of the climate crisis. And that moved us greatly and really shifted the nature of our work, because we saw that from the governmental side, there was complete dysfunction. And from the civil society side, there was a lot of anger and frustration. There were marches and even some violence. And so here we were, a group of about 15 spiritual teachers, trying to hold the space for saying, this is a spiritual crisis, not just an ecological crisis. Humanity is facing a very profound spiritual crisis. And people were really welcoming that message. And so every year since then, we've organized workshops at the COP meeting on the spiritual nature of this crisis. And people, there's such frustration in civil society, but and people come often come away and say, well, what can I do? And the words that emerge out of my mouth is food. That's within your control. There's so much that's not within our control. We can't control the energy systems. We can't control the emissions except by lobbying our politicians and through elections. But we can control the food we eat. And that's mm-hmm. something that's not highlighted enough at the UN. You know, years ago, the UN report came out and showed that the meat industry is a bigger contributor to carbon than in the atmosphere than transportation. But it was hidden. It was suppressed, that information. And every year it comes out again, and every year there's lobbying and suppression. So what can people do? They can reduce or eliminate meat. They can eat local. They can eat organic. Then you're part of the resistance, and then you are part of this "we're still in" movement, which Jerry Brown and Bloomberg and some of the others started to say, no, Americans are not pulling out. We Americans are still in the Paris Agreement. And so the takeaway from the meeting that's still going on in Poland now is don't wait for the government. It's up to civil society. We have to take the lead because the governments are not.
You're right. I've been watching it. You know, and even though one would think we've made some progress, behind the scenes, like you're saying, we're not making progress, you know? you know, we have an administration in this country that should be a world leader and be setting the stage and making, being a role model, and we're anything but. And it's just, you know, it's embarrassing to be a part of this country with this administration in, for me anyway. But at the same time, it's a great opportunity to mobilize all the grassroots organizations that are working towards change in the area of food to really come together and get this message out loud and clear. I mean, I remember when I first started getting into this, Governor McGovern, Senator McGovern back in the 1980s talked about, you know, did this whole research, was funded, and came away saying we all need to cut our intake of meat. And the lobbying from the meat industry just went berserk, and they were allowed to suppress that information. And the best that they were allowed to say was, you know, choose lean meat, you know? The extent of it, even though they know that that's what is better for the people. And so, you know, I just always say how, you know, you have to follow the money because there's such corruptness, you know? It's, you know, us being sick, getting sick from meat, getting sick from the planet is good for business, good for, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's the same thing, you know, what's going on now with the farm bill. I'm so glad you brought that up because these things get sneaked into the bill, you know, and their efforts now to roll back emissions, car emissions, and it's the oil lobby that's doing it because it will affect their profits if cars get more mileage per gallon. And so are we going to let money destroy the planet? And that, it really comes down to that. Are we going to let money destroy, you know, the Secretary General of the UN just went over there. He hadn't been there, but he saw that things were not moving, and he went over there and he said, this is a suicide mission. If we don't act, we're on the path of suicide. You can't get clearer than that.
Right. And yet, they're not moving. We still have
cabal,
a president that is still denying climate change. It's infuriating.
It's as if I don't like it, I'll just make it go away. You know, as if nature is going to follow, they'll make it go away. You know?
Right, or that you have enough money so that, you know, the thing that's also so saddening is that the impact of climate change will impact those that are already struggling more than those that have money. And people like the president know that. I mean, it's like, you know, if houses get flooded or burned, people with resources can move upland, you know? They can move inland. They can move up. They can get away from, you know, hop on a plane, get away from some of the tragedies and crisis. But, you know, if it's your one and only house, and it's wiped out. It's wiped out, you know.
Also, these refugees that are coming in from Central America, one of the factors is drought, is climate change. And this is just the beginning. I mean, they're expecting, you know, tens of millions of climate refugees from all the islands. Well, where are they going to go? Who's going to take them? I mean, we won't even let our neighbors in who are fleeing drought. So violence and also drought. So it's the Syrian war. Climate was a factor there again, changing climate patterns and drought. So it's a big, you know, it's the America. The people have to be told the reality instead of just trying to, you know, keep people from knowing what the scientific facts are, you know. And so I mean, we all have work to do in terms of educating and creating awareness about what the reality is.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us how the Global Peace Initiative is working now to get their message out and to work in these areas around the world that are struggling with conflict?
Well, we are focused really almost exclusive now on climate and environment. And so in addition to going to the COP meetings, we've been doing a series of dialogues with young ecologists in their 20s and 30s on the scene, the inner dimensions of climate change, getting them to look at the shifts in consciousness that are needed. In other words, to stop looking at nature as commodities that we can use and abuse, and to look at nature as living beings, looking at the rivers and the forests and the earth herself as a living being. So it's this consciousness shift, and we've done dialogues now with young ecologists in Africa, Latin America, North America, Europe, Asia, and just a few months ago in the Middle East from all the Arab countries. And we're working toward a global summit of all these young people, and they're a wonderful group. They're working on alternative energy. They're working on marine biologists. The people working in regenerative agriculture, and it's wonderful to see how they're forming a global movement. And they need support, you know, because this is the generation that is going to inherit the situation. Young people in their 20s and 30s now, in another 10 years, you know, they'll be at the peak of their, coming into their professional work, really, and that's when we're going to start to see some really extreme things. So these young people need the spiritual resources, and they've responded extremely well. You know, in our day, there was a real disconnect between the environmental movement and the spiritual movement. And the environmentalists kind of said, you know, you're just sitting on your cushion, what are you contributing? And the spiritual community said, well, you know, what are you accomplishing? You're not advancing spiritually. But they've come together now, and that's a really positive sign.
I'm so glad to hear that, because I came into, you know, my spiritual life early for a young person. I mean, I was, you know, my late teens, early 20s, you know, when I, you know, found my teacher and, you know, and kind of set my path. And as I got older and became a mother and was feeding my children healthy and started learning about food, if you care about food, you have to become an environmentalist. I mean, there's no way you can care about the food you eat and not get passionate about the environment. And, you know, so that kind of happened to me early on, but I found it very frustrating that I felt kind of alone in that. Like, a lot of the people that I knew from my spiritual group weren't really joining me in that area. And it was at times frustrating, because, you know, I'd say, you know, let's do this, and like, well, you know, I'm just focusing on love, and that's going to change everything. And sometimes you actually have to do a little bit more than
do
just
something.
Meditate
with that
love.
What's that? Love in action.
Right. Love in action, exactly. You need the two. You know.
Well, I experienced the same thing. You know, I came into my spiritual life also in my late teens. And most of my friends were just, you know, running off and having a good time in India. And I was a passionate environmentalist, and nobody quite understood what I was doing. I mean, even to this day, a lot of the people in my spiritual network, I don't bother to try to proselytize, but it's, you know, I mean, when the world is on fire, you can't just sit in your cushion. You know, the divine is calling you to act, and it's love and service. That's what it is. It's love and service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great. I'm so happy to know about your organization and the work that you're doing, because I was not aware of it prior to this, and yet you and I have met many years ago, and
yeah,
I have no clue that you were involved with that. So it's just wonderful.
So I wanted to tell you about a local initiative. We realized in the course of doing our work with the American ecologists that the factor that really moved people was connection to the land, and that this had to be a local initiative, lots of different local initiatives. So last June, we brought a group of young urban farmers, mostly from the New York area, but also Baltimore, Philadelphia, Boston, together up in the Catskills for 2 days of discussion. And we had, again, some spiritual teachers. There's a Lakota leader that we work with. And it was a phenomenal success in that they have stayed together and stayed connected. And the problem is that with young people, they're so busy doing their work, they don't really have time to focus on the network. And so they depend on an outsider to come in and bring them all together. And they don't have the funds, really, to go traveling around to see what others are doing. So we're hoping to do this again with a larger group sometime in the spring. And it's not an expensive thing, so it's easy for us to do. You know, we depend on grants for our work. But I think that highlighting the importance of getting everybody involved in the food growing process in one way or another. If you can't grow it, then your neighbor or the, you know, person down the street is connecting again to the process of growing food. And in some cultures, that's part of your spiritual sadhana. It is a spiritual process, the growing of food. It's not divorced from your spiritual life, because you're working with the life forces. I mean, you don't have to tell you this, but this is something that we've increasingly come to recognize, that we can't divorce our spiritual life from everyday acts. And one of those everyday acts is working with our Mother, the Earth, to provide nourishment for our bodies.
Mm-hmm. You know, and yet in our society, we've come so far from that, so removed. You know, people that shop at a farmer's market are a little bit more connected, but the majority of our country shops in a big supermarket where you can just, you know, get anything you want, the cheaper the better, and there's really no connection to where that food's coming from. I remember, you know, I'm very rarely in a regular supermarket, but I was in one, and, you know, I saw the price of, I think, a 2-liter bottle of Coca-Cola was like 79 cents. That's cheaper than a small little bottle of water, you know? Mm. And I'm thinking, No wonder why everyone's buying this stuff and drinking it, because it's the cheapest thing. And, you know, those people that don't have a lot of money, you know, that's, you know, one of the issues that, you know, the River Fund is working with all the time. You know, when you're dealing with poverty and you're dealing with hunger, you know, people are just going to try to, you know, make their dollars last as long as possible. And, you know, they're going to buy the cheapest food that they can. So in communities where that is a struggle, we need to provide affordable, healthy food so that they have better choices. I mean, you know, I don't know. It just baffles me, because those are the communities that have the largest health problems as well.
Oh, and people don't realize that the quality of the food affects not just your physical health, but your mental health. And you know, it creates destabilizes your whole mental system and emotional system. So it's a very serious problem. And I think we're just at the beginning of an agricultural movement that returns agriculture to the people. There have to be co-ops, urban co-ops. I mean, of course, they exist to some extent, but not nearly at the level that they need to in order to give people access to clean, healthy food.
Mm-hmm. And how much work does your organization do with educating people about the different types of agriculture? You know, I was talking about regenerative agriculture, you know, really putting nutrients back into the soil. Of course, you know, with Rudolf Steiner, we got into biodynamic type agriculture. Do you get into any specifics or no-till? Do you get into any of those specifics, or is it more just focusing on bringing the spiritual work into the agricultural work?
Well, when we gather people, we try to bring people from the various different practices. I've worked very closely with the natural agriculture movement, which is really promoted in Japan through the some of the Shinto organizations, they don't use any additives, not even manure. But they're also working with the regenerative agriculture. So I do work closely with the umbrella of the regenerative agriculture, but more as a convener, because I am a farmer myself. I have a big garden, but I can't claim to be an expert. So, but we always have people involved with permaculture, and it's wonderful to see how they talk among themselves. I myself try to do natural agriculture, but I do use on occasion some compost and some composting. Yeah. So you know, we leave it up to the young people to really kind of talk among themselves about which they prefer. Our main point is you gotta form this network. We've gotta grow this movement. And if we can help support you as a convener, we're really conveners, is that we bring together people. We get grants and so that we can bring together people, host them. They don't have to pay. We bring them to our site. We feed them. And we give them a platform to dialogue. So that's how we function. And it's been exciting to do it in different parts of the world. I mean, we're just coming from such a dialogue with the Arab young leaders. And it's a complete disconnect from what their government is doing. Just like here in America, we've got, you know, a whole movement that's very far apart from what our government is doing. It's encouraging to see that exists around the world. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to think of, like Saudi Arabia was just at COP, called the climate movement the climate mafia. Can you imagine? But we had delegates from Saudi Arabia who were so passionate in their environmental work. So, there are people everywhere trying their best to change the course of the human community.
Yeah, and it's a big job. It's a really big job. Everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Dina Merriam from the Global Peace Initiative of Women, and we're going to take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about your new book, My Journey Through Time. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Dina Merriam, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message can reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute, on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, will give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Bhavani and Ayi Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And Dina Miriam is my guest today. She wrote this new beautiful book called My Journey Through Time, a spiritual memoir of life, death, and rebirth. And she's also the founder of the Global Peace Initiative of Women. And so we've just been talking about the Peace Initiative, and I'd like to now move on a little bit and talk about this new book. Dina, are you with me?
Yeah, I am. Yes, thank you.
Sure. So your book is really so enlightening. It's really amazing. How did you first come to know that you had prior lives? How did that come out for you?
As a child, I had inklings as a child, as I think most children do. I think most children carry elements from their past, traits from the past, interests in the past, and then gradually they get engrossed in their current personality and their current work. So I always accepted rebirth, and it just felt very natural to me that, of course, I've lived before, and just recycling through again. But it wasn't until I was really in my 30s that I began to have dreams and visions and start to recall very concrete memories. I don't know why it happened to me. I mean, I was a long-time meditation practitioner, a very serious one. I took very seriously my meditation practice. And I think when you are involved in a deep practice, things happen. Different things happen to different people. You know, some people see light, some people travel out of their body. All kinds of things happened. None of that happened to me, but what happened to me was that my memories began to emerge. And often it was during meditation that I began to have these experiences. And after sitting with them for about 10 years, I decided, first I'd recall elements of one life. It was always tied to something that was happening in my current situation. And then I thought, wow, it took me a long time to process all that. And then a few years later, another current life situation started to awaken memories of the life before that, and so on and so forth, until I really went back several hundred years in time to a number of different births, and I began to see patterns. And I've always been interested in the workings of cause and effect, because everything has an earlier cause. Nothing is arbitrary. Everything that we do has an earlier beginning. And so I began to see these patterns building. And I came to understand more fully why I was working to promote the voices of women spiritual teachers, and why I was working in the interfaith world trying to create this balance between East and West. So my life began to make much greater sense for me. And it's an ongoing journey. It's not over. Memories continue to emerge for me. And so I'm on this kind of search for understanding of who I am and why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. And how have those memories impacted your current life or informed your current life?
Well, it helped me understand, first of all, if the past has created our present, then our present is creating our future. So I began to think very consciously about what I do and think, because as I saw these patterns from the past kind of laying the framework for my current life, I thought, oh, well, I'm laying the framework for my future. And so, you know, if there were disharmonious relationships, well, I didn't want to create any bad situations in the future. I began to more consciously, I became more mindful, you might say, about my life, and think, well, you know, I've fulfilled in this life many of my aspirations from the past. My aspirations to bring cultures together, religions together, my aspirations to work for the earth, and my aspirations to give women an equal voice on all the critical issues facing humanity. Of course, there's still a long way to do, but I'm able to fulfill my part in that. And so what do I want to do in the future? Where do I want my energies now to be directed? And so it began to really shape how I'm living my life now by realizing that I'm creating the conditions that will manifest in the future.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think for so many people as we get older, you know, one of the things that we do start really thinking about, and you don't think about it so much when you're young, if you have a fulfilling life, you know, you're not usually thinking about death. But as we get older and we see loved ones pass away and we know that our time is getting closer and that we don't have forever to live, how has knowing that, you know, there's life after this life, how does that impact your life? Or does it change? Well, you said, of course, you're more mindful, but has it affected any, you know, your outlook on death? How has that changed?
Completely. Because I remember dying. I remember my a lot of details about my past birth. I remember dying. I remember elements of the in-between stage where you're kind of setting the blueprint for your next birth. And I recognize beings there where there was a great, great love. And so one of the great teachings for me was that one is surrounded by love in a visible form and an invisible form. Visible in the people around you who love you, but also your teachers from the past who never lose sight of you. There are teachers that I've had in past births who, when the memory was recalled, I immediately connected with them and felt their love and care for me at this moment. And I also connected with a being who does not incarnate on Earth, from another dimension, you might say, once that memory was recalled, I felt an ongoing, the connection was reignited. So I don't have fear of death. Now, of course, there are attachments. One is attached to one's children, and you know that, you know, even though you keep meeting people again, it's not going to be in the same form. And so there is a preciousness about this moment. But there's no doubt that love continues, and love is the most vibrant force in the universe. And so it changed my whole relationship with death. And I kind of feel it's a natural process when your work is done, when you see your loved ones independent and able to take care of themselves, it's like an apple falling from the tree. You're ready to move on.
Yeah. It's so true. I mean, you know, as I've gotten older and I look at my three beautiful children who stand on their own, each individual and each so different, you know, you really feel like, wow, you know, this is my life's work. And, you know, and I've launched, you know, they're launched, you know, they're their own people now. And and yet they all carry, you know, parts of us with them. And, you know, it's just beautiful when you, you know, get that perspective of the cycle of life, you know, and you can feel okay, like, you know, you're complete, your life's been full, and, you know, and you have no regrets, you know, you can move on.
I think that's the next big frontier, is that humanity science will discover that consciousness continues, and that we need to make friends with this passage. And be at peace with it and not fear it. It's getting over, because so much is governed by the fear of death. So much of our collective life is governed by that. And if we can see beyond, if we can see the past and begin to envision a future, I think it does a lot to take away that fear.
Mm-hmm. And so you touched on it, but how has that recognition affected the work that you're doing now?
Well, I try to bring that consciousness to all of the work. We talk about it openly, and when people talk about we've got to save the earth for future generations. Well, you are the future generations. You'll be back. So you are in a sense creating the situation that you're going to have to face. I mean, the more the environment is degraded, we're going to come back and be born into that world. So what my experiences have done has changed my complete perspective and outlook on how I approach even the environmental work, and to help people wake up to the fact that I think we are not going to solve our problems until the consciousness of the human community evolves. And so the key here is evolution of consciousness, raising the consciousness of people so they can have a broader vision and not just think, in terms of the next election cycle, the next, stockbroker's report or their next quarter. We've got to think in the long term. We have a long past, we have a long future, and we're in it for the long term.
Right, we are. And so, you're right, and everybody listening, we will be coming back into the world that we're creating now. And so it would be nice for it to be here. Now, you also work in the business world, like the straight business world. How do you integrate this spiritual work, your environmental work, and the business world that you're involved with? Or do you have to keep them separate?
I do keep them separate in some sense, and then I'm not very active. The business is founded by my father, and he was very supportive of my NGO. He got me involved. He was very close to Kofi Annan. He got me involved in the UN work. He did a lot of pro bono work for the UN. So he started this public relations firm in the 1940s, and then my brother took it over. My brother is also very supportive of my work, so I'm allowed to house my organization within the company. I have some oversight of the nonprofit work the company does. They do work for regenerative agriculture and a Buddhist organization. And so there are a few projects that kind of relate to my work. But I pretty much just operate out of here. I have some ownership in the company, and I'm very close to my brother, and we check in with each other. But I spend a lot of my time now doing this nonprofit work.
Oh, that's wonderful, because you're good at it, and we need you. So
we need each other.
What was that?
We need each other.
Yes. So how would you address people who don't believe in reincarnation?
Well, I think it's not a matter to me of belief. You can only believe what you've experienced. And so these are my experiences. If you don't believe in it, well, there's another way you can look at things. You can look at things as, you're looking out for the well-being of your children and grandchildren. And I don't try to convert people. I say I'm sharing with you my experiences. Try to look more deeply into your own life. I've seen with my own children interests that they have. I see it with my grandchildren now. It's so clear to me. You see things that they carry from their past. How does that happen? How does that come out of me? I have a grandchild. From the time he was 3, he was talking about Tibet and remembering Tibet. And you can't explain these things. Think if you look carefully, reflect your life. And I've heard that, over 25% of American Christians now accept rebirth. So I think that people are, memories are emerging for a lot, or there for a lot of people. They just don't know how to process it. They don't really pay attention. Maybe it doesn't seem relevant to them. But I just say to people, just reflect on your life and see what your inner self tells you.
Mm-hmm. And from your book or your experiences, can you share with us say 3 main teachings that you've gained from your experience in retrieving these memories of your past births?
The teachings that are most vital for me are that there are, when you look at a whole life, I describe a life that I remember in 40 pages. There are highlights. what are those highlights that you're going to take away with you, because that's going to carry you forward. So I think a lot about what the highlights of my life are going to be. Who are the people who are going to really stand out for me? What are the things that I've done that are going to propel me forward? The second thing is the message of love. The teachers that I've had in the past, I'm still, centuries later, am so moved and inspired and nurtured by their love. They've not disappeared from my memory. So the power of love to cross over death and centuries and to still nourish and inspire one is a very powerful message. And then the third thing is forming a new relationship with death and beginning to think more consciously about the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good for everybody to take in. That's beautiful. Really beautiful. So your book's available on Amazon and most bookstores. So anyone who is interested, it's called My Journey Through Time, a Spiritual Memoir of Life, Death, and Rebirth.
It's on Kindle. It could be available on Kindle from Amazon.
Yeah, yeah, it's really beautiful. So thank you for writing it. Now, this was not your first book, though, right? You've written other books.
I started out as an art journalist, and my father was an art photographer in addition to everything else he did. So I've done some art books with him, but this is my first, my own book. I've done some other writing in the art field, and I edited an art magazine for a time, but this is my first book. But a second one is coming out early in the new year, which goes back even further in time it's called The Untold Story of Mother Sita.
Ah, beautiful, beautiful. Well, I am so thrilled that you joined us. Can you share with people how they can get in touch with your organization, and if they have any further questions, can they email you? How would you like to be contacted?
Yeah, they can go onto the website, which is www.gpiw. That's G. PIW.org. And we are also on Facebook. You can either Google, you try to get through, I have a Facebook page, and which is linked to the Global Peace Initiative GPIW Facebook page, and we're on Twitter. If you'd like, you can email me directly. It's MiriamD@GPIW.org. That's MERRIAMD@GPIW.org. I'm happy to answer any further questions or to tell you how you can get involved in our work.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I know I have a lot of young farmers that I've worked with down here on Long Island that I'd love to connect with you. And do you partner with any other organizations like the Young Farmers Association, or work with Stone Barns at all, or anything like that?
We have not the Young Farmers Association. We have invited people from Food and Water Watch to some of our gatherings, and they have come to some of the. We usually reach out to all the environmental organizations to send a participant to one of our gatherings, but not the Young Farmers Association. I should connect with them.
Yeah, well, I'll send you those contacts, because they're another wonderful group really working to help young people with land access, which just seems to be such a huge one. Land is so expensive
and so hard for young people to get
started. For people, young people to really share, some of their struggles and their support. Like you were saying, values that you offer is the support, because when you're young, you don't have those resources
exactly.
to start out.
And
that's where so many young people need. So anyway, I just want to thank you so much for joining us, and everybody
out there
who's been listening, thank you so much. It's been wonderful, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.